If Murray had supported the show, I'd be less sick of podcasts.
The Blubbity Blah.
Sending out good vibes.
Good vibes. Underneath breaths of deep gratitude and prayers for guidance and protection. And put on a didgeridoo and shamanic drumming track. Shivers or vibrations and stuff like that.
Okay, guys, welcome back to the Grime America Show. Coming at you this week with Annie Kuglis Humphrey talking about Hagen stuff and some Irish stuff. Kind of more
Norse.
Norse, not super ancient, but like mid ancient, you know, I guess like actual history, not prehistory.
Yeah.
And it seems like they even got that messed up. So.
Yeah. She really tries to show the syncretization of the Norse and the Gaelic. Was it Gaelic? Gaelic. Norse and Gaelic. That sort of stayed outside of Roman influence. So it is pretty interesting.
Yeah, it was a fun chat. Definitely was a fun chat. People should check out the book. It's another one from Inner Traditions, but it's we got another one coming up with Scott Crichton's coming back on the show, who has just came up. Did I sent you the thing for his video, right? That Graham Hancock shared?
Yeah. Is it about the pyramids or something?
It's about the pyramids. I haven't watched it yet.
I was trying to remember what her episode was about. I couldn't remember.
It was about the Osiris shaft, I think.
What about it?
I don't know. It was a decade.
Sometimes I just have these blanks with the old episodes. Like,
that's just what it was titled, The Osiris Shaft. I think that's what his book was called.
It must have been before we went there then. This must have been a long time
ago. Oh, yeah, man. This is like 2014.
Oh, that. All right. That's why. Okay.
Probably 12 years ago. 11 years ago.
Interesting. Okay. So he's got another book out, or?
Still going after the Egypt stuff. I mean, it's going to be interesting because we haven't talked to him in so long and learned a lot about Egypt in that time, went to Egypt, into the places he's talking about. So it'll be an interesting conversation.
The Osiris Shaft is a good example because it's like six levels down right on the Giza Plateau.
Yeah, we went right to the bottom, right? Till we got to the water. If you wanted to go down there. Because I started going down the bottom of that one ladder, went right into the water. So you'd have to step off into the water.
Yeah.
Which I'm not interested in doing, you know? Fuck that. That old ass. Well, I guess a lot of it's probably rain, but it don't rain there too often. And that's like the water table, right? That's where the water is everywhere.
Throughout the underground. I mean, the underground city underneath Giza Plateau. I mean, I'm at the point where I just think, because you can look over in the distance and see the other pyramids that we went to, the Bent and the Step and the Red Pyramids, and they have these massive underground caverns too. So I think the whole Giza Plateau is connected underground.
Probably.
I mean, especially when you look at Turkey and some of these other cities that they admit. And then remember the thing that Ben was talking about, the labyrinth or Saqqara. I mean, it's just... I think there's so much more underground than we realize.
I think Ben's basically saying that it's there now, right? Which I don't know how Ben feels about the new scans and all that kind of stuff. I've sort of not been super close to that. I did email a buddy to see if he would come off the show, Philip. I think his name's Philip or something, right?
Philippe.
But it would line up, you know, if those things go down. However far it is, it lines up with all that shit being down there, which is what a couple of these guys have been saying forever. And it seems like somebody knows that shit. Because the one thing there is all over the Giza Plateau is a bunch of chained up little holes in the ground. They can't go down. You might not want to go down there, but it seems like ventilation or something, right?
Yeah.
Ventilation. It's super snowy here again. Winter is back with a vengeance. Seems like headed your way. So heads up.
Oh, yeah. We've been waiting for it. It's supposed to be here now. It says it's snowing, but it hasn't snowed. So it says it's snowing.
It's not snowing so much here yet. I think it's snowing in the city. It's not snowing here so much yet, but it's windier than shit. And the temperature has plummeted from it was plus 15, plus 10. It was plus 8 to plus 12, say, on average for the couple weeks before, maybe plus 5 at the high at least. And now it's, outside right now, it's got to be approaching minus 20. It's like that. Snap. Back to winter. Looks like 2 solid weeks of this.
And really?
I
thought we were only supposed to have a couple days of this snow, but maybe.
Well, it's just the cold. It looks like the cold. Oh. Here is hanging on till about March now.
Oh, wow. Holy, yeah, you're right. I haven't looked at this like that in that regard for a while. Yeah, it's in its low 20s again now next week.
Still not a bad winter, really.
No, it says minus 26 to minus 17, kind of like, that's not too bad. During the day, it'll be minus 20-ish. That's okay.
It's livable. It's livable.
Yeah.
It's been good. I mean, I went fishing 3 times last week when the weather was good. Someone went through the ice.
I saw you had a huge fish.
Caught some big pike, yeah.
Was that a pike? I thought somebody called it a walleye, or was that something else?
I got like a 34-inch pike, I think.
34-inch? Wow. Dude, that's like 3 feet.
Yeah, Sean's pike was probably 37 or 38.
What?
Yeah.
So, and somebody went through the ice, or I interrupted you there.
Someone went through the ice on the weekend.
On a truck or?
It looked like it was a little car. I mean, I stopped driving my truck out on the ice about 2 weeks ago. I mean, there's still lots of ice in the middle. Where I was drilling through on Friday, we caught 16 fish in a day, which ain't bad. And that was like, we got almost nothing in the first 3 hours. And then it started really lighting up. Got a couple tip ups going off at once, just fish everywhere. But
what do you attribute that to? Just random or
just finding the spot? I meant to go back to that spot yesterday, but
no. I meant the three hour.
I don't know, just a slow morning, maybe. Could just be a slow morning, could be we moved a little bit, so you get out there.
What do you mean you moved? You moved around to different holes or you moved?
Yeah, we moved like 100 yards, moved the shack 100 yards. We're in some deeper water. So I have all the depth charts. I think I use iBoater, which comes in handy when you're in the boat. So you don't hit shit. But it's also handy just so you for fishing, because you're always looking for maybe a shelf between some deep water and some cold water, or some deep water and some shallow water, and or off of some underwater points and stuff like that. So we were out in like maybe 30 feet of water, and then we moved into like 12 to 15, maybe some lines even at 8. So it could have been a depth thing. But even when we first got over there, it was pretty slow to the point where we're like thinking about moving again. Then it lit up. But anyway, all that to say, there was at least 18 inches of ice out there, which is plenty to drive whatever on. You know, you probably drive a transport truck. When I was out there Friday, dude drove by in his diesel truck towing his camper, which was I don't know how heavy his trailer was. It had to be a few thousand pounds. It was a 2-wheel, you know, 20 footer almost. But the ice was really crackling. But what happens is the shore, where it meets the shore, it really melts there. So it's getting on and off of the ice that is sketchy. Wherever the water's really shallow, because the ice can't grow to be 22 inches thick there. It can only grow to be 4 inches thick. So when 4 inches of ice starts melting, that's a lot different than when 20 inches of ice starts melting. And what happens is you get these little islands all over the place that they're not really islands. It's not like a proper island. It's just like maybe some reeds that come out of the water a little bit. And then when the sun's out and it's windy and warm, all in those reeds just melts. So there's almost like no ice left in those reeds because there's only a foot of water there anyway. So at best, the ice was a foot thick. And then it's got the warm sun and the warm, and not the warm ground, but warm enough ground underneath it. That shit melts and it'll spread from like island to island. Once you start getting some open water, it can. So it looked like in the picture, like someone drove over and got a little too close to the island.
So it's not like it's too like deep there either, because it's
probably 2 feet. Probably 2 feet where that car went in was probably 2 or 3 feet deep. I would say that the picture I saw, the car was already on the bottom because you can still see half the car sticking out of the ice. If it was deeper water, that thing's going to go down eventually. If it's completely sideways, like sideways in, a lot of times you get the front end in, but the rest of the truck can stay out of the water if you're lucky. You could fucking get out backwards if you're lucky. I mean, when someone went through on Newell, like, a month and a half ago, because the other thing that happens is there's a ton of people ice fishing. So if you get in the middle of Chinook, been Chinooking for 2 weeks, there's also the ice fishing people. They tend to go to certain spots, you know. It's not like the whole lake has an equal distribution of ice fisher people, ice fishermen, home fishermen,
fisher persons.
No, fishermen. It's not an even distribution. You know, there's spots. That's how fishing works. There's also, you get sort of this consolidation of groups in different spots. And I mean, you might get 100 people out in a weekend fishing, 200 people, 300 people over the course of a week. And if it's cold, it don't matter because the next day the holes are frozen in and it's start over basically. But when it gets warm for a couple weeks, the holes stay. So you get a couple 200-300 fishermen out there over the week. They're all drilling 2, 3, 4, 5 holes each, plus they got cameras and shit nowadays, so that's more holes. And then the holes don't freeze, and then you get the bit of water on top of the ice from the warm weather, melts a little layer on top of the ice, especially right now because we have no snow. So it's just, and then that washes into the holes. So then instead of the hole refreezing overnight, it just gets a little bigger and a little bigger and a little bigger. So the holes are a foot and a half instead of 10 inches. And then you drive your truck over someplace where somebody drilled fucking 30 of them, you know, all inside a, you know, who knows, 20 foot by 20 foot radius, maybe 20 yards by 20 yards. There's 50, 60, 70 holes in there. You put your front end over a row of them and down you go.
I'm surprised there's no laws in Nanny Canada about the holes in the ice.
Well, some states
have. Like an accident just waiting to happen. How come the regulators aren't out there like clamping down?
Yeah, more open laws in some of the states. I know some of the states will have
more
like.
More what?
More open. Like some of the states have a limit on how big of a hole you can put in the ice.
Oh, wow.
Maybe 10 inch, 12 inch, 14 inch. But here, some guys, in Alberta at least, I don't know about Ontario. I don't know. I'd have to look into the laws because what some guys do is cut a big fucking hole in the ice. Same thing like the polar people do, you know? They cut a rectangle in the ice with a chainsaw that's 2 feet by 6 feet. And then they like, some dudes, they'll just fish in it. And other dudes, you see the videos of them spearing them with like the pitchfork type things. But I mean, you drive into one of those fucking things. Like, it's, you know, maybe it freezes over and it gets a half inch ice on it overnight. So you know, you can't see it.
Yeah.
And then you just drive over. So hopefully they got that car out anyway. I mean, all that to say, hopefully they got the car out. I know my buddy Eric drove out Saturday to the same spot I was at Friday. I didn't drive out. Like I say, my truck's heavy and it's big. There was people driving out. Eric drove out the next day, but the shorelines, even walking on the shore was getting sketchy. And when you went around the islands, you had to just, you know, there's lots of ice most places, but you just got to kind of watch where you're going. You can tell when you're walking on the ice, you can tell. Hopefully Buddy got his car out, because if not, it is now fucking frozen solid into the water, which is, I don't even know. That's a whole different animal. You got to get that thing out quick.
I watched a guy doing a video to, or no, somebody taking a video of a guy that walked out and fell in the ice on purpose to show people how to get out of the water when you fall through the ice.
Did he get out?
Yeah. He showed how you do it. You flop yourself like flop yourself over, kick your legs, and then get yourself up and then lie down flat so you distribute the weight and then sort of get away from it. It's pretty cool.
Even if you can't do that, I think the
trick. Gotta hold your breath, because then if you start panicking right away, not hold your breath, but like regain control of your breath.
Yeah, regain control. And then I think you got about 10 minutes. Either get out of the water, and if you can't do that, you got to find a way to like make sure that your head stays above the water when your arms stop working, which is about 10 minutes. And then you've still got another hour or two that, you know, if they get you out and get you to a hospital, you'll recover.
Well, how did we go in the lake for 10 minutes and we were fine?
In the ice?
Well, it was like just about ice. I mean, it was plus 2 or plus 5 or the water temperature.
I don't know. It's just warmer than we think it was. You know, it wasn't. The water right now was 3 degrees Celsius. So that's, you got 10 minutes before your arms start working.
Well, how are we doing in that group when we went to the lake with Brandon Powell and we're...
That water is not 4 degrees. That water is probably more like
10. Sure it is. No. Oh, you think it was more like 8 or 10 or something? Or? Oh, and it makes that much of a difference, I guess. Even
I'm not making that up. You know, like the North Atlantic is at 3 degrees, 2 or 3 degrees. And, you know, they say you got fucking 5 minutes, maybe 10 minutes. So if you can't, like, if you don't have a life vest on, or if you can't like get yourself onto like a piece of wood or something so that you can stay afloat without your arms. Now there you might have a little longer because they have those suits you put on. But I mean, we were just going through it a couple weeks ago. I think it was with Chuck, where it's like the rule is 1-10-1. You got 1 minute to get, if you fall through the ice or fall into the ocean in the North Atlantic or one of those places where it's might as well be falling through the ice. You got 1 minute to get the breathing under control, 10 minutes to either get the fuck out of the water or figure out how you're staying afloat. Because after 10 minutes, that's when you're like, arms and shit stop working. You notice this stuff right away when you're out doing something, your hands start getting cold and you're like, you can't really use your phone anymore. If you're trying to do something intricate, it gets to the point where we're out duck hunting. And your hands are so cold that you can't even like push the shotgun shells into the receiver anymore. Cause it's like, you should be able to, it's not that much strength to push that thing in there. It's a couple pounds of pressure you're pushing with your thumb. And then it's not even like you got to try and do it in a weird way. You'll get it so you can like make your thumb straight and use your whole hand to try and push that shotgun shell in there. But once your hands are fucking cold, man, it gets harder and harder and harder to the point where it's like, it's a real trip to try and do.
So what was the other one? An hour? So it was 1:10 and an hour?
1:10. Yeah, then you got an hour to get out of the water.
To get rescued.
Yeah.
So this is probably part of your fascination with shipwrecks and all these ships.
Well, it lines up. I'm over the shipwrecks now because I watched all the episodes. So I'm over those. I've moved on. But it was a pretty big eye opener with some of that water, how fucking cold. I mean, down in the Caribbean and stuff like that, you'd be fine. But you get up around Alaska, North Atlantic, North Sea. I'd imagine even like, well, people swam across the English Channel, right? So it can't be that super cold there.
Well, during summer, I think. I mean, you know.
And they might have to wear a wetsuit probably too, right?
Yeah. Probably. That's why the Vikings, like we talk about in this episode, they were summer warriors, right? They would leave during the summer, come back before the fall with their treasure and their booty.
Yeah, and I get to like come home and have a hot bath or something in between this stuff, right? Like, can you imagine if it was just like get to the end of that cold day ice fishing and fucking sleep in your teepee and maybe you get right warmed up, but you know, half the time you don't. Like starting the next day, still half chilled from the day before, and that just sort of compounds on itself. Lately, I've been actually watching. I watched Prometheus again with Shauna, my wife.
What'd you think of that after watching it?
You know, it's funny because the last time I watched it was before we started the podcast,
right?
And there were some spots I didn't remember, honestly. I probably shouldn't give out spoilers just in case people haven't watched it. But
don't worry about that. Don't worry about an old movie like that.
I didn't remember like any of the end where he like crashes the one ship into the other ship and then she heads off to the other place. But it is interesting because over that time period, obviously my understanding of like ancient cultures and that kind of stuff has grown exponentially.
Yeah.
So you just see all that stuff. It makes more sense. It starts with the symbology and then pointing at these planets that, you know, maybe that's the Pleiades, or it could be, you know, it just sort of mirrors some of the stuff that we talk about on the show where you've got different evidence in different parts of the world and it all looks the same. And they have the giants in it, right? They have the giants that are probably the Nephilim. And in all the scripture, they're pointing at the planets. So then they find these planets and they fucking go there. And then when they get there, it's shitty. And at no time that someone tries to consider, which you kind of get throughout the show. What I came up with anyway, is that's like, maybe those guys were like, don't go there. You know, you just got, you got no words. It's just a picture of them pointing at some fucking shit.
It's like, no, don't go there.
Don't go there. That's trouble.
Process of elimination. We figured out that star system sucks. Do not go there. Well, do not go to the Dog Star. Do not go to Sirius. Do not go to the seven. I mean, Pleiades, you'd think would be different because it's the seven. It's got all this. It's got quite a bit of like divine mythology, right? That seems good. Yeah,
this one that doesn't give you any of that, right? It just shows you the pictures. Then they go there, and it turns out the aliens are making or the Nephilim, it would seem, were making a. First of all, they allude that they made us, and then it seems like they were destroying us as well. They were making some super weapon to come out and level the place. But and then maybe some other guys came here, and it was like the split between the Elohims, right? There's a bunch of weird mythology baked in there that if you know a bunch of stuff about our world, then... you can start to put a bunch of this little stuff together. Like, cause I think it was like, there was Elohims. There were some of them, and there was some good ones and some bad ones, some that wanted us to be alive cause we were their little pet project, and some others that wanted us dead for whatever reason. Anyway, that was kind of interesting.
Did you listen to the director, the guy, the movie producer guy, the movie creator on Joe Rogan that was talking about that? He was talking about Ridley Scott's stuff and also the stuff he happened to be mentioning, the show that I was just watching, which I don't watch a lot of TV either, but I'm trying to make an effort to watch something interesting. So I tried that one called The Pendragon Cycle, The Rise of Merlin. And he mentioned that show. I was like, yeah, he said it was good too. That seems to be really good. And then he mentioned A Knight of the Seven Kingdoms, which I was going to watch. So I was thinking about you yesterday because I watched a couple episodes, the first couple episodes. Dude, it is awesome.
What is awesome. The seven dragons?
No, a knight of the seven kingdoms. Well, I mean the Pendragon Cycle is awesome as well, except you have to get onto Daily Wire to watch it. But the Pendragon
the book.
Well, so, what did you?
I listened to the book.
Right. Is it a different? So it was the Hedge Knight, right? The book about the Hedge Knight. Yeah. So is that pre?
Yeah, I think it's 100 years before Game of Thrones.
100 years before Game of Thrones. Okay, well, you'd love it then. You got to watch it.
Should I? I don't know. I think I seen something online, a preview or whatever, and I wasn't super blown away.
Me too. I saw something online that made me go, oh, that looks boring. But you know what? It's just the way that it's like a classic heroic. Like, it doesn't seem like they've destroyed the canon or anything like that. It seems like it's pretty just a real hero story, you know, kind of thing. I mean, I'm just starting it, so I'm not getting, but then I saw some meme about episode 4 or 5 is the highest rated TV show ever or something, or episode ever. So something happened, which must be the Knight's tourney, because he's starting to get close to participating in the list in the Knight's tourney in the jousting competitions.
It's hard to know because with the way the distribution networks are all sort of, you know, unifying and social media, it's like, it's hard to know now if it's like something got all these views because it's that good and people sought it out, or if you just like crammed it in front of that many people. What I have been watching, just started yesterday and watched 3 episodes of it, has been really good so far, is Chernobyl.
Hmm.
I think it's older, like 2018, 2019, but it's like a documentary sort of thing, like not a docudrama. Because my understanding is it's all based on what actually happened, or at least what the Soviets told us happened. But it's been fucking good so far. It really has. It's been because there's this like underlying level to it of how the socialist structure sort of fucked them. Because it's like there's a bunch of fucking retards in charge, and the people that have brains that are trying to get in there and help the thing are being held back by all these fucking retards.
Becomes a managerial class, like blocking progress.
And more than that, it becomes a managerial class that's sort of put up and built together based on favors and
nepotism.
I mean, there's a line in it where the nuclear physicist is bitching at the guy who's the city director because he was worked in a shoe warehouse right before that. And the guy, you know, clearly retarded. So, I mean, some of that's probably political programming, but it's hard to just dismiss it all as that when we're like seeing exactly that sort of starting to come out in our world today, especially in the political class. You know, it goes all the way down. It's a complete penetration, but the political class are fucking retarded, you know, and it's just like, it's the exact same sort of thing. And it's like, once they stop letting us vote for these people, you can see where it gets even worse. Because then it's just, this guy's in charge. At least voting gives us, you know, at least some illusion of some sort of control. Anyway.
If you want to hear more about that kind of stuff,
head over to GrandAmericaOutlawed.ca. There's actually a free month right now. You can get a free month of Grand America Outlawed Plus and check that out. All the content over there, the bonus content. Check it out. Try it out. But here, we don't do that kind of stuff in Grand America. We just give you all these. I think this is episode 750, actually. This is episode 750. All there, all in the back catalog, all for free. If your podcast player doesn't show them all, it's because your podcast player is shit. And find a new one or go to the website and you'll be able to go all the way back in time to the original episodes, which there's still some bangers in that back catalog that are even more prevalent today than they were when we did them. And of course, you can check out Grand America Radio on Spotify, where it's just a nonstop go of just interviews, no intros, no outros, no nothing, just interview after interview after interview with some roundups mixed in. Goes all day, 8 shows a day, and easily shareable with your friends. I just did the Throwback Sunday episode on there that had our 7 interviews with Randall Carlson. So I think it's like almost 20 hours of content there of just because I mean that could probably
you put one episode there with all Randall,
not one episode, just a newsletter. Throwback Sunday thing with the links to them, and I just compiled all the Randall Carlson ones. That's how I think I'm going to start doing them moving forward, is like find a theme them a little bit.
Yeah,
have a throwback Egypt where it's all the Egypt
show. Oh yeah, throwback ufology. Yeah,
that's the way to do it. 7 Randall Carlson episodes. So the other thing, we need support. We really do. We're trying to keep this podcast going and keep it growing, and keep doing the show. People seem to like it. We like it. It's fun. We get to talk to great people. It does cost money. It takes a bunch of time away from other ventures that we could maybe make some money. So we do have to ask once in a while that if you are getting some value from the 750 podcasts out there, edwardgrandamerica.ca/support today. Sign up for a monthly or make a one-time donation. And send some value back our way. That's the only way we make money around here, is if you guys pay us. So we hope that you do. We've been doing this drive lately where we're like, if we can just get all of you to sign up for $1 or $2 a month, we'd be laughing. We were hoping for one, but it seems clear that not everyone's going to do that. So we're hoping we get like two or three. And then when you sign up, you're making up for a few people that don't have a credit card or just can't do it. So we do have some people that seem to be answering that call. We have Laura Chisholm Photography, who we've traveled with. Hi, Laura, who signed up for $3 a month. So thank you. Takes care of Laura and a few others. We had Evan Downs, who came through and signed up for $5 a month.
And thanks, Evan.
Yeah.
And Laura.
And then we had Jess S. on Patreon, who signed up for $12.66 a month.
Oh, wow. That's awesome.
That is awesome. Thank you, guys. Again, we would just ask that everyone just goes and does that. $1 a month if you can, or $2 a month, or $5 a month, whatever it takes. You've been thinking about it for a long time. It's more important than ever. So do that. I mean, you could even just go buy, if you don't have a credit card, just go buy like a gift Visa and do your whole $12 all at once and you're good. Just buy a gift Visa once a year, do your $12 and give that $1 a month. And if you can't do that, get some audiobooks with your Audible credits from Adult Brain. That helps. Use up your Audible credits there. You have Spotify Premium. There's some audiobook levels built in there, depending on what country you're in, where you can listen to our audiobooks there and support the show. And of course, you can just throw Grimerica Radio if you're a premium member of Spotify, which most people are. I mean, really, they must do like insane conversion rates. We're trying to convert 1% here, and I bet you Spotify is doing like 40 to 60. I don't even really know anyone on Spotify that doesn't just end up with premium eventually. Because you don't want the app. So anyway, if you have Spotify Premium, check out Grimerica Radio, play that while you're sleeping. And, you know, we make a fraction of a penny every hour. So, but if enough people do that, those fractions add up. So grimerica.ca/support. Please, guys, if you can, when you can, sign up for monthly and we'll keep doing the show. Anything else? Any other housekeeping?
I don't think so. Just,
Easter
Island trip, I guess, maybe.
All right. Come to Easter Island with us. There's still a few spots left for that. We're, I think, about 2 months away from departure.
Yeah.
So contact@thecabin.com for all that good stuff. And let us know who you want to hear on the show. You got a bio for?
I do, yeah. Yep. Annie Kuglis Humphrey, Norse. This is the book, Norse Gaelic Paganism, Viking and Irish Myth and Magic. PhD, teaches history at Keene University and Ocean County College, and wrote a dissertation on the depiction of the Norse in Ireland, found in medieval Irish dynastic narratives. Humphrey is the Godi of the Kindred of Man. I think that's like leader or something. I don't know exactly what that means. A Norse Gaelic fellowship founded in 2009 and is on the executive board of the Northeast Thing. There you go.
There you go, guys. Support the show and enjoy the chat with Annie Kuglis Humphrey.
We are with Annie Kuglis Humphrey. Welcome to Grimerica. How are you doing?
I'm very well. Thank you so much for having me on.
Good. I hope I got your middle name right there.
You did. Better than most. Thank you.
I was like, I thought I knew it, but I thought I better look it up. There's that little thing. So before we get into your interesting book on, Irish and Norse type thing, which is quite fascinating. I'd love to hear a little bit more about, you know, the organization that you were in since 2009, maybe a little bit about yourself.
Okay.
So just to give some context.
Yeah. So in 2009, my partner Matt and I founded the Kindred of Man, Man, M-A-N-N, as in of the Isle of Man. So we had both been interested in both Irish mythology and Norse mythology, but people were very clear to us that they were two separate things. They never met. And so in 2007, I went to University College Cork in Ireland. And so my then boyfriend, now husband, visited me and we went to the Isle of Man. And we were blown away by how they had both Norse and Irish together. At the hotel we stayed at, the biggest stake was the Mananon, the Irish sea god and god of Isle of Man. And then the second biggest stake was the Odin. So, so we're like, wow, this is a place where Norse and Irish comes together. So we founded that kindred in 2009. At first, we weren't really sure where it was going to go, but then we were joined by Wayne Ragnar Worthy, and now we are a whole group of men, women, and other genders in South Jersey and Philadelphia, bringing the Norse and Irish gods to bear in our region.
Nice. So is the Isle of Man,
is that British then, or is that Irish? The Isle of Man.
It is a British protectorate, but is technically its own nation.
So it's
That's what I thought was so weird. It's kind of on its own in there, right?
It is. It's a great place. I highly recommend a visit.
My dad used to talk about that. I was asking my sister, I'm like, why did dad talk about the Isle of Man so much? But he was fascinated by it. I guess our roots go back to, I guess, Scottish and English. And the name Dunlop was around there. But I never really talked to him a lot about why he thought it was so fascinating, but I've also learned that it's kind of more ancient than people realize and a little more magical, I guess, too.
Yeah. I mean, they're also very well known for the TT, the tourist trophy, the big race around the island. But there's still plenty of history and really interesting stuff if you know where to look.
Right. So did you, through this process of like trying to, you know, merge the Irish and the Norse together, did you come across, what was some of the surprises you came across that you would realize that?
Well, our biggest surprise, sort of the moment where we realized like we have to do something when we were reading a folklore book. Now, the folklore books, you know, it was a bunch of wealthy white men just kind of collecting whatever folklore they could and mashing it together. So it is itself not, you know, proof of ancient stuff. But it mentioned that Midsummer, the holiday, was the time when the Druids cut the mistletoe, and we know mistletoe is sacred to Druids. They cut the mistletoe so that Balder could be slain, because in Norse mythology, Balder's slain by mistletoe. And we were just like, what? And so our kindred horn, what we use to make our drink offerings with, has a little sprig of mistletoe carved into the bottom, because the mistletoe was sort of the cornerstone of bringing the two mythologies together.
Well, and then doesn't Christianity bring that in too for Christmas? Isn't mistletoe, or does or is that brought in completely separately? Because I just always remember mistletoe from Christmas.
Right. So mistletoe is supposed to like symbolize peace. And so there's, you know, not like a really clear message of where it comes from, but sort of the legend is that, you know, Viking chieftains would meet under mistletoe and it would sanctify their meeting. And so that's why we kiss under it, I guess.
So obviously, do you think that because the Norse were pretty active on the island of Britain throughout sort of, you know, the early 80s, maybe 900s, 800s. Do you think it's sort of an extension of that? Or are we going back even further than, like, are we going into prehistory, like pre-Christ?
Well, that's a great question. So when we first started looking at this, there was a lot of assumptions that because both Norse and Irish come from Indo-European roots, that there would be like some really, really deep ancient stuff. But what my book is about is all this medieval material, this medieval records. So 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th, 13th, 14th century stuff. talking about the integration of Norse and Irish worship and religion and religious ideas happening either contemporarily or contemporaneously to the person writing or within a couple generations. You know, I'm clear in the book that I'm not saying this is absolute, definite, you know, incontrovertible proof, but it's a whole book of information that has to come from somewhere. This is, you know, clearly there is more going on than the tales say, where just, you know, Ireland converted to Christianity and then Britain converted to Christianity and that's the end. There was obviously a lot more going on than that.
So when
I was reading a bunch of those, Bernard Cornwell, I forget his name. Cornwall.
Yeah.
Books about the ones, I read all the books that The Lost Kingdom was based on.
Yes, the Uhtred.
The Uhtred series. And it kind of really takes you through that it would sort of make sense that the Irish and the Norse could end up in bed together against the English.
I mean, they absolutely did. We have plenty of mixed marriages. But yes, they are also in bed metaphorically in terms of culture.
So does that, I mean, it's like the Norse were just far away to not get sort of swallowed up by the crown when that all kind of happened. Is there any record of the Irish? Is there Irish people in Norway? Was there any sort of like retreat back there as Britain sort of took Ireland? I guess it was Ireland. The Irish.
No. You're asking the right questions, actually, but you need to think in the other direction. The settlement of Iceland had a lot of Irish people. We know about that not just from the genetics, which show a significant portion of maternal DNA coming from Irish backgrounds, Irish and Gaelic backgrounds, but also the sources, as I say in my book, there are so many Irish slaves, Irish former slaves, Irish free settlers. It's a really, really strong contribution to Icelandic history, this big Irish component to it. And so the whole island chain from Isle of Man, Hebrides, Orkney, Shetlands, Faroes, up to Iceland, and even pushing into Greenland as well, though I don't get to that much in the book. It's a space where Norse and Irish integrated fully, and people traveled between these spaces, and it was considered sort of in the same neighborhood because people were always moving around by ship.
Well, and that must have been good for your book, though, because if you're merging the Irish and the Norse, and in that's where they ended up in Iceland. I mean, Iceland today, isn't it one of the most prevalent modern countries that hangs on to old fairy myths and all kinds of myths? I mean, don't they even structure some of their like civil infrastructure around some of these?
Yes. And this does show up in the book that in Iceland, they have the Alvar, which we usually say is elves in English. And they absolutely can and do move around public works to not knock over these sites sacred to the Alvar. I got to see a fishing factory, I guess you could call it, in Grunnvik, where the whole thing had been constructed in this very awkward U shape because there was an elf stone there. But they have that in Ireland too. They have the fairy forts, the Roths, where again, bad things happen to people who disturb them. So roads will curve around them. The fairy bridge in the Isle of Man as well has this supernatural connotation. So it's very, very much in the air in the North Atlantic.
So is that mainly from Ireland or from the Norse too?
Like honestly, I'd say it's probably from both. I think it's less that it comes from a place and more that both cultures value having spaces that humans can't necessarily go. They value having entities that are not under their control, that they respect, but they keep away from it. The Icelandic thing was described to me as, you know, Icelanders won't admit they believe in elves, but they will, you know, support projects that don't disturb elf stones. So it's a sort of funny, you know, we don't believe, but just in case.
Are those basically dolmens then?
No. In Iceland, they tend to be natural features, whereas the dolmens are usually man-made. But while I don't get into my book, this whole idea of the glacial erratic and how like random boulders in a field have affected so much of human concepts of the landscape. So that dolmens are sort of the human version of a glacial erratic. And then Iceland, of course, is such a wonderful, weird place because it's so volcanic. And so the rocks have such interesting shapes. It's sort of no surprise that there's a supernatural origin to many of these rocky outcroppings in Iceland.
How much of the union between the Irish and the Norway and Norwegians? The
Norse, like, because that was, it's more than Norway, right? It's,
yeah,
it's,
how much of that is based on the Danes, right? They used to call them the Danes back in the day.
Yes.
How much of that was based on slavery?
Ooh, that's a great question. So yes, absolutely. Unfortunately, the Vikings were master human traffickers. They were very, very big on taking people and pulling them away and selling them somewhere else. And in Ireland in particular, Ireland had basically cattle and people. And so Vikings generally found people a little easier to move onto boats. So certainly the movement of people, the involuntary movement of people was a not insignificant part of the Norse and the Irish interaction. Absolutely.
Kind of like, the Africans in the U.S. today, now they intermarry. Now this so you sort of see the same thing. But I mean, the Irish, they really got the short end of the stick for a long time.
I will say that this early medieval slavery is rather different from the modern and the pre-modern slavery because it was seen as a temporary thing. It was very much a condition imposed on you rather than someone being born into it. And what's interesting too is that in the Norse sagas, they'll actually talk about Irish people who are enslaved but are also members of royal families. For them, they could be both. Both, you know, born into royalty, but also temporarily enslaved. So I'm certainly not going to say it was a kinder, gentler slavery, but at least it was less permanent. It was not an entire race enslaved. It was rather a temporary condition.
How long? How long was like, when did, and then they just like let you go at the end of it? It was like,
yeah, it depended. It depended if, you know, if you were going to be a rower on a ship, that might be do it for the next 10 years of your life and then, you know, not have much life left. Others, you know, maybe you would be the farmer's favorite concubine and end up his new wife when the old one passed, you know. It was sometimes years, sometimes decades. Whatever the circumstances were.
That's fascinating. So you're talking the main migration we're talking about from the Norse over, and this would be to UK and Ireland, was in the 800s then? So the early Middle Ages, I guess?
Yes. Yeah, so the official start is usually 793. There is okay. Some indication that there might have been some less well remarked on incursions before then, but generally 793 for Lindisfarne in England and 795 for Ireland. Lambayhead in Ireland is usually considered the start date. So I just say 9th century, that is the 800s, just, you know, make a nice round number out of it. So I'm interested in that history between 800 and 1100. That's the main thing right there. Although, as you know, you'll see in my book, there's 12th and 13th and 14th century follow-ups to that as well.
Yeah, it's hard to know when I'm watching these shows, you know, I watch these shows on the Vikings and they have them every summer. They're going out on their raids and then coming back. And I think a lot of those are based in the 800s, but you know, some people say, oh, these are wrong on history. And so you never know what to believe. But were they kind of doing that thing, like every summer going out and getting further and further sort of at that time?
Yes. And not only were they traveling in the summertime, in fact, one of the names for them was the Somorlith, the summer warrior. And that actually became a name in Scottish. Sorley is Somerly, the summer warrior. So the McSorley clan is technically named for these summer warriors. But yeah, they would recognize that Every year they could get a little further upriver. They could incorporate a little bit more of the local treasure, gather a few more local people to sell into slavery. And so before too long, they started setting up ship camps. They would overwinter. And then that's where the Viking towns come from these gradually less and less temporary settlements that come out of the summer raiding.
Wow, that's fascinating. I'm just watching this show too right now on King Arthur and how that, I guess it would be later on, I think, after all that. But what about the Irish? What was I going to ask you? I think you mentioned in your book that this stays, like, there's a this pagan kind of, and I don't think you know, it's not a religion, right? It's a more of a philosophy, but it stays like ends up staying away from Christianity, like protected from Christianity, I guess, even until today, right? Can you talk a little bit about how, especially in those early times from 800 to 1100, where it managed to kind of just keep going.
Keep ticking on.
I get it.
I like how you say it's not a religion, it's a philosophy, because there used to be this idea that there was this some, like, you know, total pagan religion that survived underground. And there's really not good evidence for that. But what does survive is this folk relationship with the earth around them. And so that is what has survived, as we spoke about with the fairies and the elf stones, this reverence for nature, outside of what the church can provide. And so that is something that, you know, I just feel like whenever you read about medieval history and they talk about the conversion, it just, you know, oh, some Christian missionaries rocked up and now everyone was Christian. And it's like, oh my gosh, but even if they're baptizing their children or, you know, being buried in a churchyard, people are going to continue doing things that they were taught to do as children, that they saw their parents do, they saw their grandparents do. And so I do think quite a lot of traditions that either that traditions have made it to the modern day, or honestly, that traditions have been reinvented. That's kind of another thing I say in the book too, that, like, sometimes we get really into this idea of, like, if something weird happens in the medieval period, it must be some ancient relic. But, like, medieval people can come up with weird things too, like the hobby horse and mumming and running around with a horned antler headdress. It doesn't have to be some ancient thing.
They were doing hobby horses back then?
Oh yeah, like the Cornish Avias tradition, Padstow May Day and things like that. I'd love to talk to you about mumming, because that's sort of a whole other thing. But it's just, people are always drawn to this idea of, like, animal human hybrids and how people are supposed to interact with the nature around them. It's always there. So it's not like a solid singular religion that survives, but this long term desire of people to integrate and interact with the natural world that would not necessarily line up with what the church wants them to do.
Wasn't there a sort of a subtle, it seems like there was a subtle infiltration of Christianity going on at the same time? I mean, it can't be a coincidence that Christ's birthday is the same day as the solstice. I mean, there's all these sort of alignments that have roots in paganism. How much of those just came along with Christianity, and how much of those were just the byproduct of turning a bunch of pagans into Christians that eventually just sort of merged into what we have today?
Oh my goodness, Darren, that is the question, isn't it? Well, you can spin multiple books out of that question. The big person here is Gregory the Great, Pope Gregory the Great, because he literally said to the missionaries going up to England that, you know, people won't be comfortable with a religion that changes everything. Please take out the idols and their shrines and replace them with images of Christ, make them into churches. Please rename their holidays into ones that are more appropriate for Christians. You also have this big connection between Christianity and the political advantage of converting to Christianity. I think that doesn't get talked enough about, that a lot of these early medieval kings aren't converting to Christianity because they're particularly religious, but because they're like, whoa, those guys have so much wealth and so much connections with Rome and with all this other stuff. I want to get in on that. So I'm certainly not saying that there weren't sincere Christians among the converts, but I'm pretty sure there was quite a lot of monetary and political gain in conversion as well.
Yeah, people seem to want to apply all this. What's the word I'm looking for when people pietus? What is it when people are religious? Like everyone was super into
piety.
It. Piety, like everyone was super. Had all this piety back then, whereas I figure it's probably more of just a metaphor of today, just with different
people.
Most people were probably like, yeah, cool, God, man, I'm busy. I got fields, I got shit to do. Same as people have today. Even most people that say they're Christian are not really, you know, there's just sort of this thing you say, and people seem to think that the result is piety throughout history, whereas I think it was more the same as today, where 9 out of 10 are like, cool, man, I got shit to do.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, like the church was the sports activities and the clubs and the hobbies and like everything that people do, you know, for fun, that was wrapped up in the church. So of course people were hanging out with the church and participating in church run events and things like that. It's not that they were, you know, blindly devoutly Christian or whatever. It's just that was the only game in town.
So what's mumming?
So mumming is this medieval practice of dressing up, usually as something that's animal headed, and then either just a completely human body, or sometimes there would be like additional structures, like to make an abias or hobby horse. And then at various festivals, usually in the summertime, because it tends to be an outdoor thing, you'd run around the village. Sometimes you'd be scaring people. Sometimes you'd be asking for gifts, particularly of beer. like it's like modern day, I don't know, Santa bar crawls or bachelor parties where everyone wears ridiculous costumes. People like dressing up. People like running around doing silly things. So mumming is you know, often depicted as this, you know, ancient unbroken tradition. But nah, it was just medieval people having fun.
It's more fun than a serious ritual type thing, or like
anthropology? Yeah. Well, it's stuff like Abbots Bromley in England has a horn dance where people put on these reindeer antlers. I mean, well, they're so big you kind of have to hold on to them. And they've been, whatever the term is, carbon dated, and also they can figure out where in the world they come from. And they're ancient, and they come from Scandinavia. So they were clearly brought over by the Norse. And so sometimes people are like, ooh, the Abbots Bromley horn dance is like this ancient ritual. And it's just like, nah, it was some guys who really liked wearing these horns and they brought them over. And like, that's the magic. That's the power, that people still find it interesting and they're still doing it. Not that it's a pageant that is perfectly preserved, but rather that humans always find ways to reinvent their relationship with the natural world.
Hmm. Darren, I have some sort of bigger picture questions about Christianity and paganism and stuff. It just makes me think, because all this sort of imagery, right? It's being quite demonized right now in some of the sort of the pop culture, you know, like I kind of feel like there's a revival to Christianity, but there's also a pagan revival and a revival to spiritual practices, and I appreciate both of them, but it's I guess, can you speak to it all about how some of this imagery gets demonized,
as in how nature imagery becomes
like Baphomet? So now anytime people mention goat horns or any kind of horns, like all of a sudden, or like the animal thing, like the mummy on the head, like any kind of hybrid animal human thing, everybody gets into this like ritual that it's a that it's an evil demonic ritual kind of thing. That doesn't mean that's what it is, right?
I mean, it's always been that way, right? Like we love Eggers the Witch, and he's depicting sort of this New England Puritan horror story that the natural world is out to get us. That's always been a big thing in Western European thought, that there is a division between humanity and the natural world, and somehow we are rational and scientific and all these things that nature is not. And so sometimes we kind of fetishize it with, you know, a lot of colonialism is built into this idea that the colonizer is advanced, but the colonized is primitive in a spooky and spiritual way. And that's, you know, what drives a lot of this sort of new age movement, where we're trying to reclaim a sense of balance, that humans are a part of the earth, but we don't have to like become completely primitive or completely, you know, completely abstain from all modern technology. We can is to integrate the two and grow. So this idea about demonizing, I mean, it's always been there. It's I'm sure it is not a coincidence that in the Western world, the demon has horns, sometimes antlers, walks on hooves.
Yeah.
It's you know, the devil is earth. Christianity is earth denying. You're supposed to not enjoy your time on earth. You're supposed to be getting ready for heaven. And so things like the devil and demons are earth creatures, and so you're supposed to abstain from them.
Would you say paganism and this heathenism would be animistic then?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. It's very, very much aware of humans as but one kind of being in the world.
Yeah. What about elementals? Earth, fire, water.
Yeah. Well,
spirits, elemental spirits.
Yeah, I'm gonna leave that to Wiccans and other groups that I mean, they're close cousins. Like, I'm not gonna malign them, but just the concept of the four elements is not really a huge thing in Norse Gaelic mythology. So I will leave to those for whom it is important.
Yeah, that's good.
But I mean, if you want to think of the world as in an elemental form, I think the tripartite, the land, the sea, the sky, that would be more the awareness, more the conception.
Darren, what were you going to ask?
I lost it.
Oh, you lost. Okay. So what about this? How do you reconcile like your academic career and the PhD thesis and this book, which seems very academic, with an animistic type thing, like, you know, with a metaphysical belief, whatever that might be? Like, was that difficult, or was there challenges going through academia, but also being involved in this?
Oh, that is a fantastic question, Graham. I really appreciate it, because that has kind of been just this battery of my life, that I am trying really, really hard to do, you know, to do the hard, gritty, intense academia, the primary source analysis, the translating the original language, you know, to do it well enough to get a PhD from Trinity College Dublin. Like, you know, I know my stuff, but I also am still an animist. I am still somebody who, you know, believes in stuff that I can't necessarily prove by text. And so I do make very careful spaces between what I can prove and what has evidence in medieval texts versus what I feel and what I see. And there have been times that I've kind of tried to walk away from that. I've tried to only be an academic, but it always comes back. It always comes back to, I do believe in this. And that's also partially why I wrote a, you know, $20 paperback book instead of a great big academic book that costs $200 and no one's going to see. I think people do want to see this stuff. And if I don't write this book, someone else is, and they're not going to do as good a job. So, so that's why I kind of bit the bullet. And instead of keeping my stuff in an academic context, I purposely walk it out into the wider world.
And was it based on your PhD thesis then?
One of the chapters is closely related to my PhD, but sort of as I'm writing my PhD, I was realizing that I need to write this book. So I started keeping a little side file.
It's a little
too weird for my PhD. I'll put it in the book. It's a little too outside, but then that's just one chapter. I've got stuff here based on what I did as an undergraduate at Rutgers, based on what I did as a master's student at UConn, independent stuff. Like it's a whole smorgasbord of scholarship from different regions and also different parts of my life too, which makes it like a, you know, surprisingly personal book.
Humans seem to be somewhat unique. Maybe, you know, if not from an intelligence standpoint, we're kind of, we're more susceptible to the environment than really any of the other sort of creatures. We need to build these homes or have some sort of protection. I mean, beavers build lodges, birds build nests, but they're also sort of born into the world a lot more capable, and they've got sort of these instincts that are built in. So a baby beaver can get separated from its mom very young and still end up doing fine. You know, birds need a couple of weeks and they're good to go, where we're humans can't even lift their head up for a year and then they can't walk for a couple of years, and then, you know, you need 10 years minimum, you know, 10 to 12 years of really protecting and nurturing those children, which is sort of seems sort of separate from most of the animal kingdom. How do these pagan and other things, how do they sort of rectify that with us? Sort of, we are sort of an outlier to a certain extent, whereas if we rely on each other a lot to survive, we rely on even like migratory. I mean, you could argue that we evolved to be just at the equator where the fruit falls off of the trees and we never need the flows, and we didn't, but for some reason, we've got this innate drive to go up where we need shelter. And like where I live, if you don't have shelter and heat, you're fucked. For nature is literally trying to kill you for a few months of the year. But then I can go out and see elk and bear and moose, you know, run around just fine. They're crossing the river when it's minus 30 and getting out the other side and shaking it off and sort of going on with it. So it's, I wonder if that is that susceptibility, what sort of brings these belief systems to the forefront, and the animism and the imitating animals, or is this more of a result of our domestication? Like if you take a pig and put it in the wild, it turns into a hog in a generation.
Well, I think you actually kind of answered this question towards the beginning of asking it, where you say that we as in humans need a community to live. We need that group of people around us to not only care for us when we're literally, you know, like can't lift our heads up, but also when we can't walk on our own, when we're learning to speak, learning to interact with the environment around us. Humans are a social animal, and there are other social animals that won't survive without other animals to help them. Certainly not to the same extent as humans. But another thing too, Darren, is you say, you know, you take a small beaver and it can survive. It can survive in a healthy forest. You put a small beaver in a, you know, blank plastic room, it's going to die of no water and no food very quickly. So it's less that humans are alone in needing each other to make it to maturity, and more that our environment includes other humans. These animals with instincts to survive from very early on, those instincts are applicable when they're in environments that can support them. For humans, our environment involves other humans.
It always has.
Even when I talk about world history,
even the hunter-gatherers, and the baby's still fucked.
Even hominins, you know, I teach world history and we start in prehistory. We start with Neanderthal and Denisovans and Homo naledi. Like we go right back to the very, very beginning. And this idea of cooperating with each other rather than, you know, having to remake the wheel, so to speak, with each birth is a really key part of humanity. So it's less that it's a weakness that we can't survive, you know, 3 hours after we're born, but more we are humans because we rely on each other.
And it's a superpower because that gives us the ability to pass down information and build on generation after generation after generation, which is what puts us where we are today in this sort of
exactly
position.
Abstract thinking. Yep.
And
the ability to conceive of the inconceivable.
They can't really pass that shit down. So I got to ask a question. I don't mean it to be combative. It does come across that way. Try not to take it like that. But you mentioned you teach history. Mm-hmm. It's got to be an interesting time to be teaching history when the status quo seems to be so at odds with what is coming out. And you may or may not agree with that, but on this show, we sort of talk to these renegade thinkers all the time, right? The Graham Hancocks, the Randall Carlsons, all these guys. We've been doing it for a decade. We've been to Egypt. We're going to Easter Island. So you start seeing these ancient stuff and you see the Cyclopean stuff. And it's, I don't know if you agree, but from our perspective, clearly there's something going on here. There's like there's something that these people were capable of that we can't do today. And I'm talking, I come from construction where I do it on a high-level construction, building hospitals, building skyscrapers, building airports. And then I go to Egypt and I'm like, what the fuck?
Well, you know, just last night I finished David Grant's The Lost City of Z. And it's a little bit of a spoiler because it's mostly about looking for lost explorers in the Amazon. But ultimately, he discovers that there are all of these incredible structures in the Amazon, but they're like underground or very, very subtle. They're not like, boom, a city. They're like the footprints of cities or whatever these things were. So when people start talking about like what has been lost, I'm really of the opinion that, you know, who knows? Who knows what's been lost because we might not even know what to be looking for. And the example I give, and I always emphasize, I'm like, I'm not saying they had the internet in the medieval period. What I'm saying is if we all of a sudden had some kind of Carrington event, all electronics stopped, all, you know, everything. And then, you know, in 200 years, all of our laptops and cell phones are all going to be degraded. You know, we're not going to be able to trace where the electricity was. And so in 800 years, people are going to say, oh, you know, this weird dark age where fewer and fewer books were being made and no one seems to be talking to each other because they're completely missing the internet. They're completely missing a technology that's very important to us, but perhaps it hasn't survived. So I'm not saying that ancient people had the internet, but I'm saying, you know, we don't know what we don't know about the ancient world.
Well, and you get to air level, you're talking about complete collapse, right? Like you get a Carrington event now and there's nothing in 1,000 years. There's not like it wasn't a dark age. It's a stone age. It's like, you know, the way the supply chains are integrated. And I was reading a thing the other day that says, you know, there's not even one place in the world that can make a pen anymore. The shit to make the pen just literally is based on a supply chain. So it's like the pens won't even work. You know, like once the supply runs out and you get a couple generations on, because you get cave paintings all over the world and petroglyphs that show the same sort of things. And you get the, so what's that like? Because you're obviously on the younger end of this coming in, but you're in a profession that is run by old white dudes and willing to defend the status quo to the point of calling the people that are challenging it, you know, racist, you know, all the buzzwords. You're all the buzzword because you're saying things that we don't agree with. And, you know, when Flint Dibble first went on Joe Rogan, I came away from that having a ton of respect for the guy. He was I was looking into him. And then over the next like 6 months, he just degraded into petty sort of, the conversation got completely sort of lost somewhere in the thing. Mm. It's like he was unable to acknowledge certain things. And maybe there's reasons for that. Maybe it's stuff that I'm not capable of understanding. But after over a decade of interviewing some of the smartest people in the world, it becomes clear that there's more to the picture that these some people are willing to defend at all cost. I mean, I would say Zalek Voss is one of them. I'm sure you've got people in your own life that you're probably dealing with, even with this stuff.
Oh, yes.
What is that like? Because you're sort of this, you're at the sort of the next group, the next generation of academia is coming up. And a lot of us on our side for the last 10 years have been saying the only way that these textbooks and shit are going to start to change what the evidence on the ground is for those old dudes to start dying off, hopefully of old age. You know,
we're not wishing ill.
But it seems like that's what it's going to take to get. I mean, I don't know what you think about Graham Hancock and Randall Carlson and these guys. Some of their stuff is kind of out there, but some of their stuff, I mean, I've been fortunate enough to spend, you know, 50 days in the field with Randall Carlson looking at the stuff that he's presenting on. And when I go stand at the edge of Moses Cooley in some of these places, I can say, man, there's no way that this wasn't caused by a torrential amount of water that happened quickly and at one time. So it's just sort of these, and I would say that that younger Dryas stuff is sort of the one thing that has probably in the last 10 years crept forward the most into, it seems to be, you know, poking its head into the mainstream at least. But I feel like you're sort of right in the battleground. Stuff that you must like know is common sense to you, but to other people in the room think you're still nuts, or are they just, they
well,
some people it's going to seem like they know they're wrong, right? Unless they're completely naive, they've got to like give it some credence, someplace. Like, you can't that nothing's changed in 50 years.
Yes, yes. I mean, I won't get into the minutiae, but there are very strong camps about what medieval Ireland looked like and what Norse integration into societies looked like. And you know, I won't say that we get into fist fights, but there have been some shouting at academic conferences. Actually, oh my God, there was one time I got into a screaming match with an archaeologist in Dublin. Anyway, but you know, no fist fights, no violence. The main thing, like to the question at the heart of it, I will mention too that I'm a historian, not an archaeologist. I respect archaeology. I've done a little bit of excavating, but I'm not trained on it. I'm trained on history. And so to hold
sorry to interrupt you, but that's kind of part of the problem. I mean, the archaeologists are trained to dig shit up properly, and I give them credit for that. But are they trained to interpret it? Don't you need like a pretty solid understanding of history and prehistory and sort of, you need like some, you need different disciplines interacting to get the
full. Yeah, and that is true. That is, you do need interdisciplinarity. Absolutely. That is absolutely true. But what I mean is, like, to answer your question, is as a historian, my realm is interpreting documents. And so because my realm is interpreting documents, I have to be nigh unquestionable. That's why I've taken so long to learn these languages, to, if not read the manuscripts themselves, then to at least see digital facsimiles of them. Because if someone comes at me going, this didn't happen, I'll be like, argue with the 12th century man, you know? And that's even when I show my students. I mean, obviously I'm showing my students primary sources and translation, but like as soon as we're into Mesopotamia or whatever, I'm like, let's look at some cuneiform, because, you know, I can just keep chatting at you, but you get to read what people were actually writing down and actually saying. That's where the information comes from. And that's who, if you're like, no, that's not what really happened, well, you got to take it up with the sources. Like that's where I don't want to say ammunition, but that's where like the heart
the value of the is. Yeah.
In
the,
value, the sources. Yeah. Yeah.
So when you lose the sources, or you get back to like some places where you got down to one or two sources, like you got Plutarch for Rome. I mean, that's
right.
What if you fucked it up? You know, so on that, how much do you think of history do you think is, because it seems like for the last 1,000, maybe 2,000 years, It seems pretty solid. I mean, I was just reading a thing the other day that seems like they might have added some years in that sometime, but
well, I won't. I have friends who are calendar experts. That is a thing. So I will defer to them. I will say that so much of 19th century nationalism colored which manuscripts were collected and transcribed. And even in the 21st century, we're still detangling such national pride, national assumptions, national categorization of manuscripts. We're still undoing that. You will still have a English-trained and a German-trained scholar look at the same material and have different conclusions based on how they're trained.
And you have to assume that's not a modern phenomenon. Right, it's been the same time after time after time after time.
Yes, that is true.
Changed the home base. So, how much of history do you think that we've got right? How much do you think we've got? I mean, you've got an unknown part that's always going to be unknown, and then you've got the stuff we do know and the stuff we think we know.
I will tell you what I tell my students: history is not what happened. It's the story we tell ourselves about what happened. So in many ways, I think history is still evolving and still changing. And people think that's revising history like, ooh, we're just making up facts. It's rather, hey, instead of walking into this assuming that this document says this, let's actually read it and actually look at it. I mean, that's what my PhD thesis was. Everyone was like, oh, when the Vikings show up in Irish sources, they're always brutish, they're always nasty, you know, they're always enemies. And I'm like, I am using my eyes and I am seeing far more than that in these sources. Let me tabulate how the Norse are depicted. And, you know, a whole PhD thesis later, here we have all this stuff. And that was, you know, one case of, hey, does it actually say that? And so that is what I think we're missing in history, that there are so many
1500 years.
Yeah. There's just so many assumptions built on assumptions that I know to people, it looks like we're just randomly rewriting history, but it's more, we're pulling out little Jenga blocks and seeing what towers fall down.
Well, plus a good example of this changing history would be what you mentioned with the Denisovans and the ancient sort of all the different Homo erectus, I guess, I don't know what the overall like term would
be. Homonyms.
But now there's like 9 different homonyms, and the modern humans go to 300,000 years now, kind of officially. So that paradigm has been changing too, modern humans and how far back our history goes. So there is some movement with the mainstream narrative as well.
Yeah. I mean, even, again, it's not my specialty, but, the archaeology I did do was on Paleo Indians in New Hampshire, and there we were looking at Clovis, assuming Clovis was the first. And even 20 years ago, you tried to talk about pre-Clovis, and you might as well say, you know, they all came from space. But now there are multiple good sources of evidence for pre-Clovis culture, and so, you know, I'm not saying you have to constantly have an open mind and there is no definites, but you just got to recognize that so-called definitively proven stuff is a lot more amorphous than I think people are willing to recognize.
Yeah. It would seem like the Clovis thing is almost proven at this point that there was.
Oh yeah. Yeah. There's way too much in South and Central America. That's pre-Clovis.
And speaking of Indians, I'm an Indian. And when I got my DNA done, it's mostly South America, and the Mohawks over in Montreal and the St. Lawrence have been growing squash for thousands of years that are native to Guatemala. So there seems to be, you know, a migration there that nobody. So it starts to seem like those people didn't come over the Bering Strait and down into South America, but the people that are in North America now came up from South America.
Possibly coming via the Pacific Islands.
Yeah, or possibly just being there from whatever before the ice sheets came or whatever came. Because you start looking at, I forget that lady's name that found the fire pits in Mexico that were like 50,000 years old. But I mean, without even getting into the woo or the the controversial stuff, there was 400 feet less water 15,000 years ago in the oceans. We were just looking at the map the other day. If you take 400 feet of water out of the Pacific Ocean, you can now island hop all the way to Easter Island, and you can island hop sort of the wet rest of the way across there. The the ocean currents come directly out of West Africa into the Caribbean. And I think that there's an argument that there might have been some black people hanging around already. And, you know, it was just
easy. Oh, yeah. So, like, the Indian Ocean was such a highway. Like, people just do not recognize it. They just want to have this world where everyone just sat around waiting for Europeans to discover them. There was so much more going on. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah,
and honestly, that's one of my favorite lessons for my world history students, where I showed them a map of the world when the sea levels were lower. And I'm like, how many of you heard Bering Sea and assumed they walked over a sheet of ice? No, it was land. They weren't just randomly crossing a glacier to see what was there. They were just following the coast.
Well, yeah, you could have sailed the entire coastline. And I mean, the other sort of interesting one is that Noah's flood appears in almost every single culture in the planet. I mean, it's like
the great deluge.
Great deluge is everywhere. I mean, around here, we're sort of the opinion that this could have happened multiple times. We could have got to where we are today, and then comet impact, pole flip, Carrington event, you pick it.
Who knows?
It's almost like you get to a certain level that you trade off this comfort and modern and technology for survivability. Because when that same shit happens, the tribes that are still running around Brazil and Africa, basically uncontacted, or even we look at them as primitive or whatever, you know, they just haven't come with us into the future. But when that comet hits, they're going to just carry on.
Tomorrow, yeah, keep on.
So, I mean, we kind of figure that's probably happened a few times around here.
I forget where the source was, but to bring this back to paganism, a beautiful thing I heard was this idea that, like, if all religion was wiped from the world, if, you know, God forbid, it was only children who hadn't been, you know, taught any religion survived, honoring the winter solstice would be the first holiday, recognizing that there's a point when the days will start getting longer again. And so to me, you know, why not celebrate the solstices? Why not?
I mean, you know, the equinox too. I mean, all of that stuff, right? All of that. Yeah. The lunar stuff.
Yeah.
So there's all these ancient sites that were pointing to these things. They have their celestial alignments, and there's solar and lunar stuff. I mean, even in Ireland.
Newgrange.
Yeah, Newgrange. I mean, there's theories about Newgrange being like an old temple.
Hello, cat.
Yeah, sorry about the cats.
The modern calendar is more tied to it all than we let on. I mean, the Christmas is basically the solstice. People think it's off by a few days, but it's not really, because it kind of sits still there for a few days. And, you know, New Year's should be on the solstice. Well, New Year's is there for a particular reason, because the days start getting a little longer on the 23rd, but the first day, because if you look at the sunrise keeps getting later still, 26, 27, 28, you're still losing seconds in the morning, but your afternoon has made up enough time to make up for it. So the day has made up more time than you've lost. So the day is still getting longer. But January 1st is the first day that comes back again. The morning time rises earlier than the 30th. Oh,
I don't think we ever talked about that, Darren.
That was Randall Carlson that showed that to me. Because I think I was arguing with him one time about how the calendar is just, he's like, no, the calendar makes more sense than you think. If you start, they pretend it doesn't, but it still ties into all these ancient things that sort of make sense.
And I'm sure you guys know about the roof box for Newgrange.
Go ahead.
Just for hundreds and hundreds of years, there was no upper opening in Newgrange, so they didn't know that the winter sun would go into it. But there had always been these legends that it was the cave of the sun, and it's where the sun went. But it was just like a hole. And then it was recent excavation where they discovered that there was this roof box. And when they opened it up again, that's when the sun hits the floor in there.
Right. Oh, I forgot all about that.
Wow. Yeah. Cool stuff.
So did you come across any of your... What?
I just republished our Swagger show on New Grange like 2 days
Yay!
Ago. James Swagger. Do you know James? Have you heard of him?
I don't know. Just New Grange in general makes me happy.
He kind of did weird, but he was an Irish guy. I believe he was Irish. That we did the whole like 2 hours on New Grange and the dolmens and all that sort of stuff around there. And the solstices are the one you find all over the world, right? The Serpent Mound and all these sort of things.
So speaking of Ireland again, just getting back to your research in your book, I mean, I don't know, this is kind of out of the book's purview, but did you come across any of the ancient myths and legends from Ireland, like the High Brazil or Tuatha De Danann or the...
Tua De means tribe of God. And so that actually referenced the Israelites, but Irish clerics writing this stuff down said, well, our ancestors were the Tua De Danann, the tribes of the goddess Danu. So that's where it comes from. So absolutely. I encountered both lore, as well as the Lower Gavala era, and the Book of the Takings of Ireland has all the stuff about the Fir Bolga, the men of bags, and the Tua De and the Milesians from Spain. So it's absolutely there in people's awareness. And it's funny too, because I can't tell you how many Irish people I met where they meet me and I'm an American, obviously. And then they'll be like, oh, what are you doing in Ireland? And I'll be like, I'm writing a PhD in Irish history. And they'll be like, ooh, let me tell you about Irish history. And then they'll tell me about something. And I'll just be like, yes, I just told you I'm writing a PhD on it. But thank you.
What about Hyperborea?
Hyperborea. Ooh, I think of Conan the Barbarian when I think of Hyperborea. Not a whole lot on Hyperborea. I do know about Thule or Thule and Iceland. Don't know too much about Hyperborea.
Interesting, because I think that was that the Norse, Graham? Was it the Norse or who is the...
Well, yeah, the North Wind. It's the...
Yeah, Boreas the wind, so Hyper is above the North Wind.
Yeah.
Fascinating. Yeah. And go ahead.
Well, I'm just going to ask about sort of the... What do you see... how do you see the Norse Gaelic sort of paganism evolving in this modern world? Kind of like, is there sort of a revival happening? Are you seeing that? Is it somewhat magical right now?
I think it's really magical. We've got Kindred of Man in New Jersey and House of Nine Waves in New York City. That's my besties group that, it's not quite hived off of Kindred of Man, but it's kind of based on Kindred of Man. And honestly, Graham, I wrote this book to see what would happen. I wrote this book to see where it's going to take people. Because honestly, I would love that in 30 years, some young scholar is like, here's all the ways that Dr. Humphrey was wrong. I want that. I want people to read this and correct it. I want people to try it and say, wow, this didn't work for me at all. I want that. I want to see where it goes. So I don't know where it's going, but it's off.
Is there anything we should address that we didn't talk about the book?
No, we went places I wasn't expecting, but you've asked some very, very good questions about being an animist and an academic that I'm flattered. So thank you. I appreciate that personal question.
Yeah. I mean, I kind of skipped over it, but I did want to know, and you kind of answered a little bit, but is there any myths about the Vikings besides them just being like, what should I call them?
Barbarians?
Yeah, let's say barbarians. Like, is there any, can you break any myths about the Norse that,
the big myth in Ireland is that the Battle of Clontarf was Brian Boru, the ultimate Irish fighter, gathered up all the Gaels of Ireland and kicked the Vikings out of Dublin and hurrah and hooray. Well, sorry, there were Norse and Gaels on either side of that conflict. And Brian himself had grown up in Limerick, a Norse town, and spoke Norse as well as Gaelic. He was 80, so he was an old man during the battle. He spent it praying in a tent. And the whole battle was to take Dublin, and they didn't even manage to do that. So Battle of Clontarf was much more a civil Irish war with a few external participants, and they didn't even achieve the one thing they set out to do. So sorry, Battle of Clontarf fans. It was not that big a deal.
Where can people get the book and follow your work?
Well, they can find it on the shelves at Barnes & Noble nationwide, which I was astonished to discover. It's also being sold on Amazon. It is being produced by Inner Traditions out of Vermont, but they're through Simon & Schuster. So anywhere Simon & Schuster goes, you can order the book through your local bookstore or anywhere else you get your books.
Awesome.
Thank you so much. Great.
Yeah, thanks.
This has been wonderful. Absolutely. Thanks so much, guys.
Okay, take care.
Come back anytime. Have a good day.
You too.
And that was a chat with Annie Cougas Humphrey. What'd you think?
Good. Yeah, that was fun. I got the links in the show notes for everybody for the books.
Why are you trying to stick up for the Vikings when you just want to be a Norse guy? Yeah? You just wish you were Viking.
Well, I have like, I don't know, 5% of my, you know, DNA goes back to the Northern Europeans and Norse, you know, most of it from the UK. I mean, I'm a mix of all that stuff. So.
Less than
no, you know what? I just, you know what? To be honest with you, it was a question that I had. I think it was either from AI or from the PR about that, about the myths. And I'm really interested in that because you watch these shows and it's all, you know, like, rah, rah, the Vikings come over and just plunder and then take all their thing back. But then people say, that's not quite like that. So I'm always curious.
Well, they managed to be able to build cool ships and shit, right? That takes some sort of sophistication.
Oh, yeah, they had sophistication. And I love the magic part of the Irish and the Norse.
That's just kind of what happens when you get sophisticated and you're more sophisticated than your neighbor.
Yeah, we should have probably talked about more magic, actually, but.
Next time, big thanks to Annie for coming on the show. Big thanks to you guys for listening. Even bigger thanks if you support us over at grandamerica.ca/support. If you are getting some value from the podcast, we ask that you head over there and sign up, even if it's $1 a month. If everyone signs up for $1 a month, we'll shut the fuck up. People have been actually responding to that. So sign up today, cost you $1. If you don't have a credit card, go buy a Visa gift card, pay the whole $12 a whole year up front. Then you just don't have to think about it for another year. America.ca/support if you can, when you can. America Outlaw.ca for the podcast. Contact@thecabin.com for trips and events. And adultbrain.ca for audiobooks, ebooks, and other. Other than that, we love you guys. Thanks for listening. And we will see you next week. I bet you think I'm
Silver steel.